We will only go back when the government takes back these laws, whether it takes 1 month or 6 months.
Farmers plant seeds of dissent. It's Monday, December 7th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, U.S. farmers face shifting winds, learning the long-term effects of COVID, emergency visas for reporters, getting through the winter, COVID concerts. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Tens of thousands of farmers in India are protesting new laws that aim to dismantle government-regulated farm trade and usher in sweeping agricultural reforms. Anjana Pasricha has more for us from New Delhi.
They have come from their villages in tractors and trucks stacked with rations, blankets, and firewood. In the morning, they cook their meals. In the evening, they huddle inside the vehicles. Camped on highways leading into Delhi, these farmers are protesting new laws that will change the way they have sold crops for decades at government-regulated agricultural markets and pave the way for private trade.
How will I sell directly to a private buyer? My produce is too small to transport to neighboring areas like Delhi to bargain for a higher price. The government market is within 10 kilometers of my village, and it is easy for me to sell it there.
Most farmers have traveled from the northern states of Haryana and Punjab. In these lush rice and wheat-producing regions, farmers sell their grain at prices set by the government. They remain unconvinced by Prime Minister Narendra Modi's assurances that free markets will ensure better profits and transform Indian agriculture into a modern industry.
We have seen what has happened in some states that dismantled government markets. Private traders bought wheat and rice at much lower prices in Bihar and Uttar Pradesh compared to what we got for our crop.
Farmers, most of whom own small plots of land and earn meager incomes, also fear that privatizing farming will eliminate commission agents at the government markets. While they are often criticized for skimming profits, these agents also serve as a line of credit for farmers, whether to buy seeds or for family emergencies.
These middlemen have always been our ATM. If my child is ill, he gives me a loan. If I need anything, he gives me money. And this works well. We won't have access to this when big private companies will buy produce.
The farmers are in no mood to compromise on their demand that the government ensure a minimum price for some crops to protect them from free market forces.
As long as we stay, these tractors will be our homes. We have brought rations for 6 months.
We will only go back when the government takes back these laws, whether it takes 1 month or 6 months.
As the numbers swell and calls to scrap the new laws become more fiery, these protests could be the biggest challenge faced by Prime Minister Narendra Modi in a country where agriculture sustains nearly half the population. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
There's much more in our top story. We invite you to read and see more by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia, and you're welcome to stop by the voanews.com website. Stay tuned. While Indian farmers are protesting, farmers in the United States have their own questions. We'll tell you more on VOA Asia in just a moment. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. United Nations says relocation of Rohingya refugees to remote island must stop. Is China reinforcing its position in Himalayas along disputed borders? Afghan activists cautiously optimistic about new protection for rights defenders. Infuriated by new laws, Indian farmers hit the streets. Pakistan says Afghan border fence nearly complete. Expanded coverage of all these stories and much more are found on Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as our website. That's voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. President-elect Joe Biden's selections to lead cabinet positions provide insight into how he plans to govern once he assumes office in January. VOA's Kane Faribault reports, while many farmers in the Midwestern United States may not have voted for Biden, they will be impacted by whom he picks to lead key agencies.
After a tumultuous 4 years marked by trade uncertainty and now a global pandemic, many farmers across the country still supported President Donald Trump. Despite ongoing and unsupported claims of voter fraud, they are coming to terms with his loss in the November election.
It appears that the president's chances grow dimmer day by day.
I certainly think that you could see instances of fraud and manipulation, but I find it hard to see that there would be that on the scale that would be needed to turn it around. Yeah, I think it's done.
Fred Greeter and Brian Duncan both farm crops in the Midwestern state of Illinois, where President-elect Joe Biden won a decisive victory fueled by support in densely populated areas like Chicago. But rural Illinois, where President Trump was popular, is important to the nation's agriculture industry. Although about 1% of the U.S. population lives on a farm, the agriculture and food industry represents about 5% of U.S. gross domestic product. Illinois is one of the country's leading exporters of corn and soybeans, crops both Greeter and Duncan raise on their farms, which is why they are interested in whom Biden picks to lead the United States Department of Agriculture, or USDA.
I'd rather see someone who's more production ag-oriented to fill that role, who can understand the needs of rural America and the farmers, because really USDA is the one advocate we have in administration.
That's the person that has to go to the president and make sure that they advocate for what agriculture's needs are. So that's going to be a key one. But the other one, I think, is the USTR position. And whoever that trade representative is will be a very, very key person for us. Closely followed by that would probably be who the director of the EPA is.
Mark Gebhartz is the Illinois Farm Bureau's Director of Governmental Affairs. He works with government agencies on behalf of Illinois farmers to guide public policy, which includes environmental regulations and trade issues.
There's a lot of unknowns, especially when it comes to China. And as you know, China is the big player in the game when it comes to the dollars and the purchases they make.
Under President Trump, tens of billions of dollars in government aid flowed to farmers to offset losses and profits resulting from the administration's escalating trade disputes, mostly with China. Despite recent progress, China hasn't reached pre-trade war levels of purchases on products such as soybeans.
They're still purchasing more from the competitors of the United States than they are from the U.S.
University of Chicago political science professor Robert Galati says the benefits of the Trump administration's trade policies may not be realized until well after Trump has left office.
Biden is in a better position when it comes to trade policy, in some sense, in a negotiation sense, because of the actions that the Trump administration has taken. At the same time, though, it's been quite disruptive.
Farmer Brian Duncan is taking a wait-and-see approach as he prepares for farm life under a new presidential administration. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Bloomington, Illinois.
Happening now in Asia, Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga has pledged $19.2 billion to achieve zero carbon emissions by 2020, stating the government will take a big step forward in environmental investment. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're starting a brand new week together on VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us today. Japan's space agency said its helicopter search team on Sunday retrieved a capsule carrying asteroid samples after it successfully landed in a remote area in southern Australia as planned. The Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency said the spacecraft Hayabusa 2 released the small capsule Saturday and sent it toward Earth to deliver samples from a distant asteroid that could provide clues to the origin of the solar system and perhaps life on our planet. The return of the capsule with the world's first asteroid subsurface samples came weeks after a NASA spacecraft made a successful touch-and-go grab of surface samples from the asteroid Bennu. China, meanwhile, announced this week that its lunar lander had collected underground samples and sealed them within the spacecraft for return to Earth. Early Sunday, the Japanese capsule briefly turned into a fireball as it re-entered the atmosphere 120 kilometers above Earth. About 10 kilometers above ground, a parachute was opened to slow its fall, and beacon signals were transmitted to indicate its location. Meanwhile, here on Earth, journalists who face persecution and violence should be granted emergency visas to help them find temporary havens. That's according to a prominent group of lawyers from Britain and Canada appointed to safeguard media freedom. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Mexico is one of the most dangerous places in the world to be a journalist. 8 journalists have been killed there so far this year.
When I leave with the idea, with the simple fact that going after the story is a risk.
At least 61 journalists have been killed in Pakistan since 1992, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. In many countries, reporters are targeted simply for doing their jobs. The high-level panel of legal experts on global media freedom, convened by Britain and Canada and endorsed by the United Nations, is calling for a global system of emergency visas for journalists facing persecution as one of 9 key recommendations.
What we're talking about here, in the great majority of cases, is journalists who are under immediate risk and need to move, often just temporarily, to safety until the risk against them dies down. Seeking safety at that point is the only way for those journalists to avoid a number of potentially very, very serious harms: kidnapping, forced disappearance, arbitrary detention, violence, or even assassination.
Relocation is not easy. Obtaining a visa for another country can take weeks and is often expensive, with no guarantee of acceptance. Those seeking political asylum must usually first arrive in their destination before applying, impossible for many journalists subject to persecution.
The international framework for safe refuge isn't working for them.
Journalists are often forced to seek alternative routes to safety.
Often they're pushed to maybe flee to a neighboring country, maybe where the border's more porous, and the journeys are just difficult and dangerous.
Safe refuge has been granted in the past.
For example, during the Iraq War in the mid-2000s, the government introduced visas for individuals, including journalists, who had ties to American companies because they were being targeted. So you see certain responses by governments occasionally.
The panel of lawyers is calling for such a system of refuge to be formalized and rolled out among states committed to the protection and promotion of media freedom. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to find them easily. With VOA Asia, you can also follow radio program host VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. Archaeologists in Thailand have unearthed a rare 5,000-year-old whale skeleton to the west of Bangkok, originally discovered by a bicyclist who spotted large vertebrae coming out of the ground. You'll find all the big stories throughout the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, China is gearing up to roll out a huge coronavirus vaccine initiative. The Associated Press reports provincial governments across the country are placing orders for experimental, domestically made coronavirus vaccines, although health officials have yet to say how well they work or how they may reach the country's 1.4 billion people. The Associated Press says more than 1 million Chinese healthcare workers have already received experimental vaccines under emergency use permission, but there have been no indications about possible side effects. Nearly a year into the global coronavirus pandemic, doctors are monitoring patients they call COVID long haulers, people who still suffer from symptoms months after they've recovered from the immediate effects of the virus. Anna Nelson has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Michael Reagan got infected with COVID-19 in the early spring of 2020. By May, he thought the worst was over. But in June, he was still coughing blood, had difficulty breathing, his hands were trembling, he would faint from time to time, and his heart was racing. What is more, he never regained his sense of taste and smell.
I smell phantom smells, like I smell something burning at all times. I smell smoke. And often, you know, in the night, I'll wake up and in my pajamas, I'll run into the apartment and I'll look to see if something is burning, and it's not, it's me.
Reagan is what doctors are calling a COVID long hauler, a person who has never recovered from some of the worst effects of COVID-19. And he's not alone. There are thousands of others suffering from the same syndrome. Reagan and a group of other long haulers started an online group and even held a Zoom meeting with a representative of the WHO.
One of the specific factors are that people have relapses, so you seem to get better and then you get worse. Your symptoms come back, you have new symptoms appearing at random times.
Today, scientists agree that COVID-19 is a systemic disease. It affects various human organs, including the brain and nervous system. Recent research published by neurologist Igor Kuralnik found that about a third of patients who survived COVID developed alterations of brain function. Symptoms included feelings of disorientation to coma. And that is true for patients with light forms of COVID or even those who didn't have any symptoms.
It takes some time for people to go over the first minor respiratory presentation, then have a free interval out of, you know, without any symptoms, and then present those lingering neurologic manifestations.
The problem of long haulers is growing, and special clinics are starting to open across the U.S. to specifically help such people. At a Seattle clinic, Amy Compton Phillips, the doctor who treated the first COVID patient in the U.S., is trying to learn more about long haulers.
We do have a large study going on now with citizen scientists trying to understand, what are people's symptoms and what are they experiencing, starting from the time of their diagnosis through, to really see what, if we can figure out, is it 35% that's long haul? Is it 10%? Is it 75%? You know, I don't know. But we're trying very hard to learn.
And Michael Reagan hopes they have some answers soon. Like many long haulers, he still can't work. The most he can do is go for a short walk with his dog. For Anna Nelson in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Coronavirus questions. Can the virus be spread by mosquito bites? Is there a vaccine or medication that prevents it? Is there any medicine that cures it? The answer to all of the questions is no. The best steps to take: wash your hands, cover your cough, stay at home if you are sick or advised to by local authorities.
Now on VOA Asia, charity organizations in the United States are seeing a 50% increase in demand due to the pandemic and economic slowdown. And as VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias reports, the Samaritans are struggling to provide help this winter season.
Thank you.
Picking up donations at the Salvation Army and other charity organizations has become essential for Erica Sanchez, a cash-poor mother of three in Washington, D.C.
Right now, it's helping us a lot because we don't have means to buy jackets, boots, so we come here and they give them to us.
The Mexican-born prep cook was laid off when the restaurant she used to work at closed thanks to COVID-19. She found part-time work collecting trash at an office building, but can barely make ends meet.
I used to earn $13 an hour in my day job. Now I earn $16.10 an hour, but only work 4 hours, so I can feel the difference.
The Salvation Army's spokesman, Major Srikant Nagar, said that with new unemployment claims nearing 800,000 a week, community needs are surging.
We are a rich country, but people is here also in the United States don't have food, don't have place to go out of the pandemic because no job is available and people is suffering right now.
Hit with income cuts, many Americans aren't paying their utility bills. The piled up debt is at $24 billion, say energy aid organizations. Customers who can't get relief risk getting cut off in the cold winter. That has charities distributing winter coats in high gear. But they too are struggling against the pandemic.
The largest percentage of coat drives that happen every year are employee engagement coat drives. So many companies are still working remotely. So right now, we are down by 56% of coat drives that were happening at this time last year.
I have to tell you one more thing.
It's not only warm apparel that's in need, says Jackie Horstman Didio, whose nonprofit provides free education to preschool kids in Alexandria, Virginia.
Usually we would serve about 15% of families with things like rental assistance or different opportunities to access food and supplies and internet. But now we see that just growing up so much that so many people need those additional services.
And if the cold weather worsens the health crisis, as some scientists expect, there could be new layoffs. That worries parents like Esau Muñoz, who works as a chef.
The truth is that the restaurant's numbers are down. People don't want to go out, especially now that we again have to close at 8 p.m. At 9, we stopped selling alcohol, so it's had a very negative impact.
Until the virus is under control, he doesn't expect the restrictions to end. Muñoz is bracing for a long and uneasy winter season. Veronica Valderas Iglesias for VOA News, Washington.
As you know, COVID cases are exploding across the United States, and it remains unclear how long the pandemic will last. But in Washington, the Kennedy Center is cautiously working on a comeback, as Karina Befrigin reports.
Two of the three main stages at the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts remain closed. But Washington, D.C.'s premier art center is cautiously reopened its opera house. Live performances resumed in October, but the experience is different. To prevent the spread of the virus, only 50 people are allowed in the audience, and they are seated on the stage.
So the idea was to put everybody here on stage, put the audience on stage, reverse the relationship between the artist and the audience so the artist is playing onto the stage.
Temperature checks are mandated. Seats are well over 6 feet apart, and artists must pass a COVID test before the performance.
The mood has been wonderful, and that's part of the experience of being on stage here at the Opera House. Because as you walk through backstage and you see the memorabilia from past performances, this is a new experience for the audience. They're having a chance to be on stage, which is not something they normally get a chance to do.
It feels wonderful. It feels wonderful to make music in a larger space. I have a very nice studio, but it's confined.
The center recently renovated the opera house's ventilation system and offers one performance a week. Tickets for the performances are selling out in minutes. Everyone here says no recorded performance can compare to being on stage and seeing the eyes of people in the audience.
It's just energy that goes back and forth. You can feel it if the audience is really silent, even the applause at the end.
The Kennedy Center has scheduled only two live performances for December. Officials hope to carefully open up even more as conditions improve in 2021. Karina Befrajan for VOA News, Washington.
That's our program for today. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Continue online with us on Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We also thank those who help bring the program to you every day. Managing Editor Diane Gao and our VOA Asia team, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, and Keith Lane. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day ahead. Be safe. Be well.